Hi Calvin, we had to reconnect because of the loss of the quality of the sound, and you were just talking about
Yeah,
the
I can hear
relationship
it
between mass and matter and the difference of
then.
coordinate systems for that.
Yeah. That's okay, I'll launch straight into it for you. In physics, and in particular in gravitational studies, we have three forms of matter. We have inertial mass, active gravitational mass, and passive gravitational mass. On the right-hand side, what we do in this illustration is we show geometrically and mathematically the difference between mass and matter in physics. On the left-hand side, you can see that mass, with units of kilograms or lowercase, is simply a equilateral scalar measurement of electromagnetic energy per second or per c squared. So E divided by c squared equals mass, which can also be measured as seen as a measurement of energy density per square meter, because they are flat Euclidean geometries. In the case of matter, however, we have a standing wave topology, and that standing wave topology is made up of four mass energies. It's not units are a capital KG, just to differentiate between the two. Again, we use colors, blue for mass energy and green for matter. But it's a measure of energy per c to the fourth, or energy divided by c to the fourth equals matter, versus mass, which is energy divided by c to the c squared. And also, you could describe matter as a measure of energy per cubic meter. Or, but I hate that term purely because per cubic meter draws up pictures of a cube when we're talking spherical volumes. It's a bit like using entropy calculations, c to c3, in with relativity. Shouldn't be done. But all that aside, what you'll note down the bottom of line running across is that 2D masses, bosons and photons, can be described in terms of energy, can be related to energy as mc squared equals the energy content. 3D matter, the fermions, the baryons, etc., the particles, capital M, c to the fourth, equals the energy. Now, it will take you a bit of time to absorb it and to play with it. It really is a confusing arrangement. But that is the relationship between mass and energy, and the relationship that the constant between the two is c squared. Obviously, seconds versus second squared, or c squared versus c to the fourth. But these are extremely important points to bear in mind, hence why I keep laboring on about them at times. But they're important in understanding universal gravitation. 70.10 is the next one we'll discuss, and it's a continuation on the formulas that we just discussed. If you take those same formulas, rearrange them, you have mass equals energy per c squared, and you have matter equals energy per second squared, or c to the fourth. Relating mass directly to matter, without the energy in between, you find that mass divided by c squared equals matter. And that's because the energy content per c squared is mass, the energy content per c to the fourth is matter. The difference is c squared. So if you take mass, which is E divided by c squared, divided by c squared again, you'll get E divided by c to the fourth, which is matter. It is all complicated, I suspect, purely because people use the word mass matter so interchangeably, and because they both have the same letter, and because the scaling factor is C squared, it begs the obvious question, which I continue to post on my social media forums to great disgust to people who are mathematically inclined or high up in physics. If E equals MC squared, which everyone is familiar with from very early age these days, and if a mathematician has a basic understanding of algebra, why is it that when I ask the question, what does M divided by C squared equal, that I have yet to get an answer, even though these answers are in the book? It seems that when people know E equals MC squared, the process of dividing M by C squared absolutely confuses them. That's the way it goes, but it just highlights how confusing mass and matter can be. Even a simpler question of saying, what does energy divided by C to the fourth equal, will raise eyebrows, because, and that's despite C to the fourth being in a lot of the relativistic equations. So we've really nailed down and differentiated in those two illustrations the difference between mass and matter in a few ways, in terms of seconds, in terms of C spatial units, C squared, C to the fourth, in terms of geometry, topology, their names, their energy content. So we've really separated, as Tetrionics keeps claiming, between mass, energy, and matter. And that's the key. Because this next one, 7101, is the beginning of quantum gravitation, the explanation. What you see in that illustration of 7101 is quantum gravity itself. We have a deuterium nuclei, and we have a, and that illustration is not quite right, but anyway, it'll work, and we have a electron. The deuterium nuclei should be missing the electron, that you can see it in the middle there, but either way, the deuterium nuclei is displacing vacuum energies. It has a chem field of its own because it has a positive charge. That charge radiates out in the form that you see there. The electron is in motion, and because of its negative charge field, is attracted to the positive charge field via superposition to the deuterium nuclei. The force of interaction, the strength, will be determined by the energy, by the K constant or the G gravitational constant. Well, actually, force of interaction will be the G, capital G, plus the K. You have the convergent gravitational fields pulling in attractive motions, and the Coulombic K constant, which is energy squared, will be pulling the electron to the proton in order to balance the charges. Energy in all its forms seeks equilibrium. The summary of that picture is that that is an actual atom at the quantum level. That is its gravitational field, which is the gravity plus the electromagnetic fields, all interacting to draw those two particles together. Its geometry can be scaled up, as we have seen, to the cosmic scale for planets and stars, or planets and satellites, in order to and match the formulas of Newton and Einstein. Where we're talking purely matter, the capital G represents the vac forces, that the matter topologies create around them that interact, where the electromagnetic fields are interacting. We're talking Coulomb's constant. They're differing strengths, but to date, all we've done is we've looked at, not the particles, but we've looked at the planets in motion and observed their motions to calculate the force. At the forces of electric interaction are far superior, and they're at closer distances, so they overwhelm gravity. Whereas on a logical scale, the vastness of space makes gravity the superior force, because the vacuum energies go throughout all of space, whereas the electromagnetic fields around a body are localized to that body, where strength goes. So what I'm saying is, at the quantum level, that model there is accurate for the gravitational quantum gravity effects, where magnetism vastly overwhelms gravity. But when you move it back up to the cosmological scale, the matter of the planet displaces a lot more vacuum energies, and it has an electromagnetic field, but it is not as great in effect as the displacement of the vacuum energy fields. So therefore, the roles, gravity becomes stronger and more dominant over larger distances than the electromagnetic does. Even though they both have identical formulations, Coulomb's versus Newton's gravity laws. 7102 puts a nail in another coffin, and that coffin is the discussion and the continued hunt for the graviton. The graviton doesn't exist. We've shown that the graviton is simply a result of mathematically modeling a convergent force of gravity with no understanding of the mechanics that creates it. If we try to even make the graviton using tetrionic geometry, we can see that it's vector points in the reverse direction. It can't work that way. It's a physical impossibility. It should have been discarded mathematically. It is definitely discarded geometrically. But I suspect it will still take some time before people give up on the idea of a graviton, as probably just as long as it will take for them to give up on the idea of gravity waves.
Calvin, we'll can I just that. Interact on what? That? Because
yep.
In that sense, the tetrion actually is the graviton. The tetrion displaces the vacuum and thereby creates the pressure which people call gravity. And so if people seek something that would have the function of the graviton, then it is not something that pulls, but something that is pushed. And then the graviton is actually the tetrion. So at the
no, because they're looking for a force.
Yeah, I know.
They're looking, they're looking for a force, which would be the vacuum energy.
Yeah, but, I'm just going by the vacuum energy is actually
made up of photons.
Yeah, I'm just going by the notion of the people are looking for a particle, and if they look for a particle in which you can associate a particle with the force of gravity, then the tetrion would actually combine that, but in a different way than people interpret it. So I'm just proposing that as a kind of bridge in understanding, so that people can sort of come to look at it from the other end, even though a further reinterpretation is needed, but that's why you are discussing this as you do now.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, like, in the strictest sense, when I did look at it, I had a similar idea. But when you look right into their definitions of gravitons, they're very specific. They're just like the electromagnetic force carrier, the photon, but they are their energy, their linear momenta, their force vector, is reversed to match up with Newton's equations with the negative g, always convergent. The only geometry that you can get to do that would be that one that's drawn on the left-hand side, which is a photon with inverted G's. and they don't exist. You can't make that geometry. I know what you're saying about the tetrion creating the gravity, but when it creates that, when the topology displaces the vacuum energy, what's really causing the force is the vacuum energy trying to push back in, and the vacuum energy is made up of photons. So yeah, I know what you're saying. I've had the same thought in my head when I was working through universal gravitation, trying to figure out how it worked, and that's how these graviton illustrations ended up coming into my work, because it is important to explain what they are. And in either respect, I mean, like, the tetrion just ends up being the quantum of gravitational matter.
Precisely.
And the thing that's creating the force is that displacement of electromagnetic energies, or the vacuum energies.
The most important part of a paradigm shift is that the old understanding needs a new handle in the mind to be able to address it.
Yeah. Yeah.
For many people, that flip in thinking always requires letting go of the old conceptualization to be able to grasp a new understanding. That's like if you're standing with both feet on the ground, if you don't move your foot, then you'll never go to get ahead. But if you don't move the other foot as well, then you'll never get to step forward. And a lot of people keep on standing on the model that they use, and as a result cannot get away from the perspective that they're using. So a paradigm shift is actually a step forward in the world of understanding. I was just trying to see.
But you still got to keep the old stuff there at times.
Yeah. But it's helpful.
You've got to provide that bridge.
Precisely. And you realize at some point that the tetrion was not a photon. And in the same way, you realized that the graviton does not exist, but the tetrion actually encapsulated that understanding of what causes gravity. And just in passing, we now came to that point where others can also use that as a stepping stone or a turning point to come to that different understanding.
In truth be told, I mean, like, as I developed this understanding of universal gravitation, for quite a long time I had two models, and both models explained differing aspects and some of the same aspects very well, but they had deficiencies. And it wasn't until I looked at the idea of topology creating one force and the electromagnetic fields doing another force that all combine to give us what we see as gravity, that all the pieces fell into place. And of course, the usual story that involved going back and changing a lot of work and reworking what I had there. But you're right, you've nailed it, because even I had to develop ideas and then abandon them. But you'll see that some things have stayed in my work purely to explain the way that they're presented at the moment and whether they can or cannot be real. And it's not easy to convey in illustrations. But the paradigm shift, as you said, makes this harder, because you're really taking people not just out of a comfort zone or increasing the pressure, you're changing how they see things. And that just requires a lot more effort and a lot more time.
Not just that, but once you graduated from kindergarten to university, it is very difficult to step back as well.
Yeah. Took a few things in tetrionics, like mass matter and the formulation. I still look at it at times and go, could that possibly be right? I mean, like, there are just some things that even my brain at times still look at it and go, wow, really so? Then I think about all the things that interrelate to give me that answer, and it reassures me that I'm still on track and I haven't made a mistake somewhere along the way.
Calvin, would it be possible to elaborate that understanding by which you realized that the concept of the graviton was not helpful, because at the moment there are many people who are taught that concept in school, in university.
Oh yeah.
And as a result, they think that that's a tool that they need to use to work in their mind with the understanding of how the universe works. We already have this very in-depth understanding of what gravity is. We now started on your understanding why the graviton is not helpful. Would you be willing to elaborate a bit on how you got rid of that understanding of the graviton and what you were able to replace it with? Because that, of course, is the kind of path which most people will sort of miss the turn in the roadmap of their mind when they try to follow the new model which is now available.
Yeah, I can do that quickly, but in all honesty, we're probably better off doing another topic on it. But I'll add a bit here,
okay,
just so that people can... I'll elaborate on what we're just discussing here on illustration 7102. The graviton was invented firstly out of mathematical convenience using math. And it came about because Newton's equation has negative g in its formulation. The negative's there to show mathematically that it is always attractive, or it's always a convergent force. Now, the current physics and all the rest don't explain where force comes from or what energy really is or how it creates force. It's just a certain amount of it creates a force, or the square root of it is the linear momentum. Tetrionics with the geometry was great, because from the start we could see that the electromagnetic field and its particular geometries gave us scalar energies at the quantum level, and that the square root of those scalar energies, i.e. the height of the equilateral triangle, gave us a vector force called linear momentum, and that vector force also had associated with a vector velocity, but that's aside. So it's the equilateral geometry that creates force at the quantum level. I've applied this in other work, and you'll find it throughout my book. I'm just trying to think which one covers it the best. It's either mathematics book, or it'll be the QED book, but anyway, probably QED, because it goes into volts and work and things like that, power. Very early on, I could see the electromagnetic field, the photon, came out as a unit of force, a mechanism for shifting electromagnetic forces from one point to the other, just like a boson shifts charge, electromagnetic charge, from one point to the other, because it's an equilateral shape, one field, so it either has a positive or a negative charge, whereas the photon has two triangles, it's a neutral charge. So when the photon was discovered and understood, and its role was understood in QED, they immediately knew that it was a force carrier for Coulomb's work in the formulas that we've seen here before, which is very similar in formulation to Newton's, bar this constant and this negative sign in front of the G for gravity. Whereas gravity only works in one direction, Coulomb's law works in two directions. It's bidirectional, it's interactive versus strictly convergent. So when Maxwell unified the electric and the magnetic to give us the photon, and Einstein showed us where the photon was, how it worked, and we could start to understand some of these forces in the work that QED did, the natural assumption was, well, if the photon works so well for Coulomb's equation, can we apply the same reasoning to Newton's gravitational formula? And the simple answer is, mathematically, yes. And some of these assumptions, as I call them, lead us down a lot of blind paths. And sadly, it's easy in mathematics, with no models and no geometry to provide grammar and structure to your assumptions, to make an assumption and just keep expanding it keep expanding it and correcting it in order to make it fit what you're chasing. And that was the case with the graviton. What happened was we knew that we had radiant light that expands out bilaterally in two directions from the source. So the assumption was, well, you reverse the vector direction and you'll create a graviton where instead of spreading out, it attracts in. So it will pull matter or create a force that pulls between two objects and brings things together. I've never seen an explanation for how this field is created in order to, or the gravitons are emitted in order to pull things together. I can understand a field of gravitons pulling things in, but we've never detected a field of gravitons like we've detected an electrostatic charge field. That aside, in the investigation for Tetrionics, I thought, well, how do you build one of these things? And when you read up on it, they are identical to electromagnetic photons. They're made of a mysterious material or energy that is not electromagnetic, otherwise we'd know them as a photon, or we'd know them as a slightly different type of photon that works differently. And of course, their vector forces have to be strictly convergent. They have to point inwards. So I drew it as drawn in that illustration, 7102, and that created the model of the graviton versus the photon that you can see on the same page. The real problems that came about with it was that despite there being a geometry, there was no evidence of what this thing was. It was a bit like dark matter. It was something that was invented. And at this stage, I'd written four books on QED. This was the fourth book. And I'd never, ever had a particle that had the vector force pointing inwards. There was no place for it. There was no reason for it. And try as much as I could not find mechanics to create or release them anywhere in physics. Because up until that point, I'd made the fields, the bosons, the photons. I'd made the particles. I differentiated between mass, energy, and matter. I showed where charge came from, what created it, what its role was, and all my work had matched all the other physics equations. There simply was not a reason for a graviton. At that point, I started looking at the singularities in the hope that somewhere or somehow there would be some condition that would create a particle with a geometry like this, particularly with black holes or something like that. And when I started investigating that from memory, I noticed singularities in the EM fields. And that was when I clicked to the divergent properties of the EM fields or the chem fields interacting with matter topology somehow in order to create gravity. I knew gravity only worked in one direction, whereas EM fields work in two directions. So again, still a roadblock, still a bit of thinking to do. And I'm stuck with the graviton still because I can't dismiss it because it's doing what I need it to do. The key point was when I really sat down and thought about matter topologies and the mass energy in them and realized that the mass energy creates the EM field and that EM fields are mass energies. So I then had to ponder, what happens when you make matter? And obviously, at this stage, I knew the ether existed. The universe was filled with electromagnetic fields that had radiated out. Wavelengths have grown longer, they've grown cooler, but they're still out there filling the universe. and I knew the distinct 3D volume of matter, but I also knew that once matter forms, nothing can get inside it. I thought about photons getting inside and being stored and things like that, and it couldn't do it because the wavelengths of the mass energies on the side of matter are way, way shorter than the waves of than the wavelengths of vacuum energies. So I ended up with this situation where inside matter topologies was empty. And I had to think to myself, what is the effect of that? And that's when it dawned on me that the effect of that would be that it would displace the vacuum energies where the matter formed, and in doing so, those vacuum energies would be under a slight pressure. Just as Einstein says, the pressure gradient, the matter topology forms, displaces the vacuum energies, and increases the stress energies in that region. What's the consequence of that? Well, as Newton says, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And there was my strictly convergent vector forces that the gravitons were trying to describe the function of. So then I had this problem where I'd answered the question using matter topologies, and I had these gravitons sitting there. Could I just abandon gravitons, just dump them? Because I can't make them using Planck quanta. The linear momenta faces the wrong way. So it'd have to be a unique being created, which then sparks a whole heap of other particles that act really strange. So I dumped them. And I felt sure that one of two things was going to happen, as it always happens in tetrionic theory as it was being developed. It would either resolve itself and the model would continue quite happily, or I would come to an impasse somewhere down the track where, again, gravitons would be required and would be needed to explain things and make things work. That point's never been reached. I've managed to continue through, model everything for all the forces, all the strengths, explain all the interactions, and I don't need the graviton. Even Newton's negative G was completely accounted for by the displacement of vacuum energies. And the other thing that nailed it in the coffin in that respect was the displacement of vacuum energies creates a force far weaker than the forces created by electromagnetic radiation or photons. And that tallies up perfectly with our understanding of physics as well. The gravitational force and the gravitational constant are much, much weaker than the electromagnetic force. So to date, after having abandoned it and having looked at it, it probably prompted me to, for a while, give it some serious study. But having abandoned it, I have had no need to put it back in. And if I spent time and was forced to put it back in the geometry that it's shown there, it would imply that there's another universe with particles moving the opposite direction of what we understand right now. Not physically moving the opposite direction, but they would be, how would you describe it, inside matter. Their linear momenta would be reversed. As bosons, bosons would physically move backwards. Photons would stand still. A whole farm full of really, really strange, peculiar properties, which I'm sure we would have noticed by now. So I don't suspect they ever will be needed. And I tried my best. I thought I had to explain them. And in the end, I didn't. Same sort of thing happened with gluons. At first, I dismissed them. I thought, you're kidding yourself. I can explain how everything's built for the particles without gluons. And then one day I sat down and read all the properties of gluons and realized that the current description of gluons is in fact a description of the neutral tetrion. And as a consequence, there's a section in my QED book where I talk about gluons and neutral tetrions and explain their relationship to one another. They are one and the same particle. Where something can be incorporated, I incorporate it. Where it can't be incorporated, I find half a dozen reasons why it can't be incorporated and make sure that everything that I need to explain is explained using the mechanisms that I promote. I have no need for a graviton. It's a can of worms that just doesn't work properly. And if it did, we would have some very strange physics going on out there. It's a mathematical convenience born out of mathematical manipulations of current math without understanding. That's just my blank statement on it. The mathematicians won't like that statement. But that's what it is. An assumption was made that if we wanted to explain gravity, perhaps we could borrow from Coulomb's law and QED and just reverse the force directions of the vectors, but it hasn't held up. I'm quite willing to put stuff in where it fits, but this one doesn't fit. Nor does black holes.
Can you briefly illustrate the reason why black holes are not needed in tetrionics? Again, as you said before, that might be also nice to have that into a story of itself.
It will be. Same sort of... The black holes were brought about... Oh, again, mathematics, Einstein's equations... It was before Einstein as well, to be fair, but Einstein's equations indicated or hinted at the fact that the speed of light is the maximum speed of anything, and that gravity bent the speed of light. It attracted it because mass and matter aren't understood. So Schwarzschild, during World War One, sat down and did some of the calculations that Einstein hadn't done and said, well, if the star gets big enough, its gravitational mass will be such that it will be strong enough to not only attract light, but stop it getting away. And it will literally absorb the light or freeze it. And it will become black. Now, black, I think they were called dark stars early in the piece, before this, had been postulated for a while. And it all came about because of this idea that something was so gravitationally massive that light couldn't escape, and that this gravity was, upon further analysis, would keep going to the point where it crushed and collapsed matter beyond that of a neutron star into a point of nothing. You couldn't see it because the light couldn't escape. You could only detect it because gravitationally it was holding other objects around it and affecting objects around it, because it supposedly had all this gravitational matter. Now, the big problem with tetrionics was that tetrionics shows that matter has three dimensions. It has a volume. If you try to collapse it down, fair enough, you might get to what they considered to the degeneracy of neutron stars or something like that. You've still got matter stuck, little blocks of tetrions stuck on top of blocks of tetrions. If you wanted to go further than that, the problem presented that you can't, because if you try that, it'll just cause one of the charged fascia, one of the Higgs bosons, to shoot out at an odd angle as the matter collapses. All that's doing is releasing mass energy as radiant light. It's just like how a star works. And we know that black holes don't shine. They're black. They've got all this mass matter. So that didn't make sense either. The other part that came up was that obviously they, as they're collapsing, they collapse to this point of singularity. And then at the point of singularity, questions were raised, what happens? And then I don't know when that started, probably in the 1920s, may have been later, but it hasn't stopped since. It's led to black holes, wormholes, multiverses, all sorts of weird and wonderful things, time travel, exotic matter. The list goes on and on, and it's just a case of rampant speculation without foundation going on. When tetrionics was further developed and I looked into fission and fusion, things like that, I looked at what is powering the core of stars. Now, I already had this hint. I knew that from my paper models, if you built a tetrion, you cannot collapse it. You try to collapse it, it's even if you folded it flat, that can't be a state for electromagnetic photons because they're a diamond shape. You try to collapse that tetrion, it's going to spread out like a photon in two directions. That's the way it goes. So I had that clear understanding, and I had an understanding of the field geometries, obviously, as we've discussed here. So the more my thoughts on fusion developed, the more I came to question things like, if fusion in the star occurs at 10 million degrees Celsius, why is it that at 100 million degrees Celsius on Earth, we have no fusion? All the things that don't quite gel. Chemistry threw in a few other little creepy crawlies, in that the carbon nitrogen oxygen cycle doesn't work. Many things weren't adding up. So I had to sit down, like all the other work, and try and figure out what was going on. It wasn't a day long, it wasn't a week or a month, it took years. Churning ideas backwards and forwards, working through the illustrations, revising them, applying them, seeing where they led me. And in the end, the inescapable conclusion was this. When matter is converted in a star, no matter what process you're going to do, it has to release the energy as light. The simplest and logical process for that to happen, Occam's razor, was simply that tetrahedra matter, 3D matter, was being converted into 2D radiant mass energies. So, in other words, you had some matter sitting in a space with immense pressure on it, and it somehow that matter got collapsed. And in that process, its mass energy is released as radiant light and heat. And that had to be how stars were working. Well, that then had to be modeled out, and in modeling it out, it became a very simple model. Just like the fields you've seen before, just like a photo, you were left with a north and a south pole and an electromagnetic field, electric field. The sun is a charged body. It's a positive charge. So we had two positive chem fields back-to-back, stationary from a relative point perspective, and neutralized north and south poles. So even though there were magnetic poles on the sun, they're nowhere near as pronounced as on the Earth. Drawing those field geometries, they all converge at a point of singularity, where the electric and the magnetic reverse. They come to a zero point and they swap, and they both do it at exactly the same point, right in the middle of the sun. The implications were unavoidable. I mean, like, that had to be what was going on. It explained so many things, like the temperature gradient within the sun. It explained, by this stage, fusion was left in shambles as to the current model. I'd rewritten the periodic table, rewritten the spectral emissions of light, and rewritten elements, compounds, hydrocarbons, etc. So I had a very good handle on how elements change from one to the other, including changing the current model of isotopes. When I applied the knowledge of chemistry and spectral lines to what I saw or what we knew was happening or being produced by stars, the only logical conclusion was that matter was being collapsed into radiant energy within the star. Now, bear in mind, current physics does not differentiate or distinguish between mass and matter. 10 years ago, they were saying E equals MC squared, the sun is converting mass into energy. Last couple documentaries I've watched, they've actually said the sun is converting matter into energy. So whether they're slowly figuring out they're not making much sense as to what they're saying or what, I don't know. But from my perspective, I know that the secret to powering the sun is the conversion of matter into energy. It's not a fusion. This idea of combining 5 protons to make a helium atom to release energy does not work. Cannot work. Will never work. Whereas shattering a chunk of matter, a standing wave, and releasing that standing wave energy as radiant mass energies is more than achievable. We do it with sonoluminescence. We can do it with fission. We can do it inside a hydrogen bomb. There was just so many factors pointing to the conversion processes. And again, all of this work, I still hadn't gone past that zero point. There was no reason to go past that zero point, because if you take a large EM field, a large photon, and put a smaller photon on top of it, they line up. The magnetics sit on top of the magnetics, the electrics sit on top of the electrics. I don't know what there's probably a geometric term for it, self something. It's not fractal, but it's self-scaling. It's probably a good close word that people might figure out. It follows the same geometry. No matter how big the field gets, it's the same geometry down at the quantum scale. And we know, well, I know from tetrionic theory, that the smallest quantum of energy is a boson, half a photon, one equilateral triangle of energy. So where it comes to singularities, I could see the singularity existing. I could see the divergent gravitational field forces pointing back to the singularity, just as you can see in the illustrations we've spoken about lately. I could see the divergent electromagnetic radiation flowing away from the singularity to give us all the effects. So I thought to myself, if the singularity's there, what do we see? And bear in mind, there's another thing about it that how would you say this? I'll simply say, if there was an electromagnetic field present in space, what would you see? And the simple answer to that is, you would see nothing. If it is no longer collapsing matter, because there is no matter to collapse and all that is left is the electromagnetic field, you would have an electromagnetic field with interactive forces that can push and pull. It will be sitting there and it would be black, because you can't see it against the background. You see right through it. It matched the description of a black hole. As I developed the model of gravitation and realized that universal gravitation is a case of convergent as well as electromagnetic forces, and I figured out that a EM pinch is what drives the stars instead of fusion, it suddenly became abundant to me that the sun's releasing energy by collapsing matter, hydrogen in this case. If you had a pinch that was sitting there and it wasn't consuming matter, but the pinch was still there, the electromagnetic field was still there, and it was a massive electromagnetic field, it would be indistinguishable from a black hole. What happens to matter that comes near it? It either gets attracted or repelled. If it gets attracted, it will be sucked in, And if it is matter, it will be collapsed and it will release a bit of radiation. The electromagnetic pinch mirrors all the processes and all the properties of a black hole without the need of a body of matter to hold light, be so gravitationally strong that it gobbles things up, and to have some magical explanation of all this stuff that it's gobbling up is going into the black hole singularity and disappearing from our universe forever. Well, that's not what happens. When it goes into the pinch, it gets collapsed and released as energy, a la Hawking radiation, if you want, a la whatever. Bear in mind all the theories about black hole evolution and black holes and all the pictures. We've never had a clear picture of a black hole yet. All the mechanics of gravitation, once I'd figured out the mechanics based in tetrionics, explained these rapid motions of stars in the center of galaxies, where they said it's got to be a black hole. There is no other explanation, physical explanation, that can possibly account for this except black holes. Well, an EM pinch will account for exactly the same thing. And an EM pinch is made up of normal Planck quanta, has no need for passage through the singularity. In fact, it prevents passage through the singularity. And it works, and it solves one other problem too. The EM pinch also provides an explanation for dark matter and dark energy. As the pinch increases and releases more energy, the divergent energies will increase, dark matter will increase, things will appear to move, well, will be pushed further apart as the divergent energies increase. But there will also be an increase of convergent energies back to the center, acting like extra gravitational forces. So there's lots and lots of things in cosmology that are in the book, and gravity ties in with a lot of things, but so does electrodynamics and quantum mechanics. They all interrelate. Whereas electrons to this day are still claimed to be point particles, I show quite clearly they're not. In fact, they have three tetrions to them. They're far from a point particle. If I had to name a point particle, I'd call it the tetrion. Something with three tetrions is certainly not a point particle. Mm-hmm. But this is the way it is with physics. There's the top-down approach leaves a lot of room for assumption, and affords no concrete model on which to base your work, your math, all those sorts of things. All the physics we're doing at the moment, all the math of physics that we're doing at the moment, except for the speculative stuff, is based on observations from the macro world. It's not based on, it's like somebody coming up and saying, here's a photo of a house from space by Google, I'd like you to build it. Or where's the bathrooms, and well, I know it's got five bedrooms and two bathrooms. They're in there. Surely you can figure it out from the photo. That's what we're sort of doing with modern physics. And sure, a bit of math and a bit of thinking around, you might be able to get a reasonable model going. But then when you get down there and look at what he's built, you go, that's nothing like the house. Whereas building from the ground up, you've got a blueprint. You've only got certain size bricks that will go into certain size holes certain ways. And it forces you to accept things that you weren't taught. It forces you to accept things you may not like. But eventually, you develop a very clear picture of what is and what is needed, what isn't needed, what is possible and what is not possible. And that's the power of tetrionics. It's, as I say, it's the grammar for this language they call mathematics in science. There's no logical reason for a graviton, and there is a geometric way to build it, but it is of no use, and I do not see how it would be made that way. it's literally working against the laws of physics to have the linear momenta go backwards. It'd be like pushing on a person on the bike and he rides backwards towards you. Well, you're pushing, and the harder you push, the faster he comes towards you. It's a completely never seen in physics, never will be. So I'm happy to discuss it with physicists and whoever to try and nut it out, but same token, they've got to understand that my model works from Planck quanta right up to fusion, to galaxies, birth and death of the universe.
As the saying has it, some conflicts are best avoided, because when you go into the conflict, sometimes you can actually affirm the believers in that perception, while if you show how it can be done otherwise, and how for the others it might be simpler to do it otherwise, then by their doing it, they can actually discover for themselves that it works better. Yes, there is a long-standing tradition of trying to convince people in their convictions, but in the work I do, you can see that on basis of freedom of choice, people will take decisions which will then create convictions, and out of that they will have reflexes which basically run their life for them.
But if you
don't come back from the reflexes to the convictions to the decisions, you can never come back to the freedom of choice, where you can actually only be to go from one idea to the other.
I did a lot of soul searching.
I was just wondering where we are now in the exploration and the conversation, if we would do wisely to round it off, because we are now getting into the level where from a clear description of tetrionics, we came back to a clearer understanding of why you created tetrionics. We started with this notion of, okay, what is gravity? And you stepwise, with the slides to accompany it, explained how in tetrionics you can see that gravity is a result of the way the force fields create matter. In the explanations, it also became clear that we do need to understand that the tetrahedral form of matter is of a totally different nature than the triangular Planck quanta which form it, which are at its basis. But also that once you see how the interplay between the two takes place, and how space and time, time and space respectively, correspond with that, then it's also possible to see that whatever Newton tried to formulate and what Coulomb tried to formulate is actually part of the same story, but it is not in the same dimension. If you do not account for the difference in the dimension, you cannot see that there is a loss of symmetry when you go from one level to the other, that you go from a two-dimensional to a three-dimensional or back again, that without that understanding you cannot see how the forces of gravity are the result of the three-dimensional structure, but that the forces of the electromagnetic interactions already play along earlier and keep on playing along when you do have that material gravity effect, with the consequent measurable weight. So you brought a whole lot together, but at the same time you have stuck only to the principles of tetrionics which you are explaining throughout the stories. At the end of your explanation, you talked about the reason why in tetrionics you do not need gravitons. In fact, you tried to work with it. You tried to see if you could accommodate for it. Then you realized that you needed to try to work without it. And in fact, you discovered that without it you can explain everything for which in physics the concept of the graviton is used. So, as before, you've already shown that in the use of tetrionics, it is possible to integrate and unify the understanding of physics as it is currently being used, but also that it is possible to correct errors and even to eliminate concepts which are no longer needed. The last step of the exploration was to apply that to the notion of black holes, which, as more often, is a mathematical construct which is created to try to create a balance in the equation, basically to get the plus and the minus interchangeable in some of the sums. But when you look at tetrionics, then it is possible to see that everything what is being explained in terms of black holes can be explained in a different manner by tetrionics. I assume that it would be a good idea to talk about that separately at some other time. And also, I would welcome if at some other time we could talk about the precise dynamics of what happens when triangles are put together to form a tetrahedron. Because we haven't really looked into that as yet. We have looked at the playing with the triangles on the table, and the way any child in preschool can already come to understand the principles of quantum theory. We've also talked about, you explained how in tetrionics anybody can create the models of the atoms. But I think it would be helpful if the connection point between the 2D triangles and the 3D tetrahedra could also be explained, because that, of course, when people are able to make that switch to see how forces in 2D are different from material structures in 3D, that they can also have a better understanding why it is so important not to confuse mass and matter, and also why there is this difference in the way we operate in time or in space. So would I work with you if we take that up some later time? But perhaps you could round off what we have talked about today, about gravity, that we do not need gravitons and we do not need black holes. And if you would like to pursue deeper levels of what we've just been discussing.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I can quickly say, you've covered it well. I'll quickly just summarize with a couple pictures, and that is 7105. Once I find it. And these three pictures just summarize what create the GEM force, the GEM force. As we discussed, between two objects of matter, or one material body, that is the 3D topological displacement of vacuum energies by tetrahedral or multi-tetrahedral mass energies, standing wave mass energies, creates a convergent force that's called gravity. That can be crudely related to Newton's pure gravitational force. You can then say that as per illustration 7107, that in addition to this displacement of vacuum energies with matter topologies, those matter topologies themselves always have an electromagnetic field surrounding them. The electric field follows the same equations as the gravitational field, has very similar properties, inverse squared properties so far as strength and etc. But those fields are restrained to the equatorial regions of an atom. They're the fields that accelerate. In the case of the Coulombic fields, they attract and repel particles. In the case of stars, those very same fields create the equatorial E-fields of the stars themselves and accelerate. They produce the solar wind. They accelerate particles towards the Earth. In the case of the Earth, those E-fields form Van Allen belts to protect us from those charged particles. The third and final force, which is obviously the magnetic force, resides as equal, same as the equal strength to the E-fields, but they're at the north and south poles, obviously, top and bottom. They're closer. They don't extend out as far as the equatorial E-fields. They're located closer to the topology of an atom or the topology of a planet or star than the E-fields are. So their effects are closer in, obviously being magnetic. They create Lorentz forces that create aurora, things like that. But as opposed to E fields that accelerate particles, the M fields perturb, or they bend particles to create auroras, things like that. Basically, you could describe them as ampere force. They're the magnetic force. If you had two planets or two particles moving side by side, dependent on their charge, they would either attract or repel via these magnetic forces. So if you wanted to map all these forces to create a simple equation or an understanding of GEM fields, the gravitational and the electromagnetic fields of all bodies, be it a particle, subatomic particle, or a star or a planet or a galaxy, you come down to the final picture of GEM fields, which is 71010, I should say. And you can see in that equation that, once I get it on my own page, that there's a coupling force in the middle between the two objects. There's an electromagnetic field between the two objects, which interact via mass energies, which are energy per c squared, and that the matter, or energy per c to the fourth, which is the objects themselves, also create a displacement. All those forces combine, their vector forces, they combine to give a net gravitational force. And that's what gravity is. Gravity is the result of matter displacing vacuum energies, and the mass energies of that matter interacting with mass energies of other matter. But if you don't realize those three forces are at work at the quantum, or at all scales of physics, you're left with erroneous mathematical models that attempt to explain mechanics based on large-scale observation. And that's where it's gone wrong for the past 400 years that we've been trying to solve gravity. We've been chasing a micro or a quantum understanding using a macro view, and you just won't get the full mechanics. You may guess as to the mechanics, but tetrionics being built from equilateral triangles arrives at this understanding and this model of gravitation using very rigid rules. There's no suppositions, there's no extra particles, there's no similarities that can't be explained. And in fact, during the process of arriving at the final answer, we've in fact explained why Coulomb's force looks so much like Newton's. We've unified those two. We've brought quantum mechanics into the fold, and we've merged it and explained how it compares with general relativity in order to give us the final model of universal gravitation. And that's what's summarized in the final picture, which is the quantum GM fields, or space-time fields, illustration 7114. It gives you the atom as an electrostatic particle with its chem field. It has two chem fields that cause it to be stationary. And you can see how charge, mass, matter, kinetic energies all combine to give us relativistic energies. And the forces that they create in any spatial region create a net force, which we observe as gravitation.
Calvin, congratulations. As usual, you have a beautiful picture in which you have a lot of ideas come together, united in a model that is new for all people, which you discovered over a number of years by just looking at the nature of the Planck quantum, coming together now in the understanding of how gravity works and how the universe is kept together by it. I suggest that for now we end this recording and this series, after which I'll come back to you and see how we can explore the understanding of tetrionics further. Thank you very much, Calvin.
Sure. Not a problem.
Thank you.